Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I will be talking about uncovering. If you've been listening, you know I've been talking about cover story, the story that we present to the world, pretty much like those that spies use, except that we believe it and the spies don't. So I've been talking about cover story. And today, I'm talking about undercover. That's the stuff about ourselves that we had forgotten, hidden, are in denial for. I'm going to talk about undercover, and I'm going to talk about the quality of denial and how it saves our lives. That may be a concept you're unfamiliar with. Then I'm going to play an interview that I did with Robert Mann, an independent filmmaker and comedian, a man who discovered film at 8 years old and was so hooked that he made it his life. So, hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about learning who you really are and having learned it, trying to become it. If you've been listening, you know that I believe that we learn very young what works in our family and what doesn't work in our family, what they expect of us, what they need us to be, what they want us to be, and then we have a reaction to that. And we do what we think is the most likely to get us safety and love. Sometimes that looks a little weird. For example, you probably know people who fought with their parents and were difficult and got into trouble. And maybe that doesn't look like they're trying to do whatever it is that's going to get them safety and love. What that probably comes from is the idea that that's what was expected of them or what they were told they were. Maybe they had a little temper tantrum at two, and that particular set of parents absolutely cannot tolerate any diversion from what's expected, and so they said, "You're a bad boy. You are just bad, 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 bad." And the kid kept hearing bad, 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 bad. And so he came to believe he was bad, 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 and acted out of his bad, bad, badness. This idea that we have of ourselves that we develop very, very young is what I've been calling our cover story. Your cover story is something that you believe about yourself, and it may even be true. I mean, in this case, that temper tantrum certainly was true. But it's never the whole story. And in the case of this unfortunate young man, all of his capacity to be good had to go undercover. That's where the qualities that don't fit, that don't go with what we think we have to be, ought to be, must be, they go undercover. So in the last week it was all interview. Oh yes, I suppose I should say, in case there's anybody who's listening for the first time, usually what I do is in the first half of the show, I talk about these things. I use my 30 plus years as a psychotherapist. I draw on my clients' experience and my own. I use the concepts in the book I wrote. The book is called When You Can, You Will. And I talk about how we come to be who we are, who we come to think of ourselves as who we think of ourselves as, and how that's not the whole story, and how not having access to our whole selves can undermine our lives, and how we can recover those parts of ourselves. In the case of this bad, bad, bad boy, it would obviously be in his interest to be able to use those parts of himself that were good when he wanted or needed to. So I'm talking a lot about how we discover what we had to put undercover and how we recover what we had to put undercover to be able to use all of the things that we are. This week I'm going to be talking about undercover. And the second part of my show, I do interviews with people who make their living or their life with their art. Because people who make their living or their life with their art in our culture are people who, at least in that part of their lives, are exactly who they are. Because it's so difficult to do that you really have to be it and in some ways have no choice. So, and there will be an interview later with Robert Mann, an independent filmmaker and comedian. I suppose I ought also to tell you that I do have a website, and it is thelynshow.com, thelynneshow.com, and that you can go up on it, and you can buy the book. You can listen to all the old shows in case there is a concept that I mention, or even one that I don't mention but that you see in the list that you're interested in, or an interview. I've done dozens and dozens of interviews with artists who have different art forms. And you might see somebody there that you're interested in, or you might see a particular art form that you're interested in. You know, if you're interested in blues musicians or jazz musicians or actors or fine artists, you might find one there whose interview you would like to listen to. So that's all on my website. Oh, and you can email me, of course. Click on email, and you can ask me questions, or you can tell me what you think, or you can say whatever you like. So I'm going to talk about undercover today, and I've been talking about cover story, and just as your cover story protects you, it also limits you. Pretending to be something you're not means denying something you are. So if your parents were uncomfortable with smart kids, then you had to pretend not to be so smart. If they were only comfortable with helpless kids, then you had to hide your ability. If they only liked smart kids, then you had to always seem to know the right answer and hide your ignorance. Feelings and behaviors or qualities that would make you a child your parents wouldn't want became dangerous liabilities, and they probably remain so today. Whatever you believed you had to be became your cover. Whatever you believed you'd better not be became your undercover. Your cover is what you show, hoping that it will bring you love and safety. Your undercover is what you hide, fearing it will cost you love and safety. And remember, in the example I gave earlier, sometimes it doesn't look like that. But in the case of the bad, bad boy, safety came not from being good, but from being who they thought he was. And so he clung to that even when it didn't seem to be giving him love or safety. Your undercover is what you hide, fearing it will cost you love and safety. That is mostly the way it is for us. Even though you gladly present the one and carefully hide the other, both are true of you. If when you were small, you decided that a particular quality was bad and you successfully hid it undercover, then now exposure of that quality is a danger you probably avoid at all costs. It's impossible to amputate feelings, behaviors, or qualities from our personality. They all continue to exist within us, but we have a very human mechanism that allows us to think that we don't have them. Human beings all come well-equipped with the capacity for denial. Denial has a very bad reputation, but denial is a gift of our unconscious. Without denial, we could none of us get out of bed in the morning. If we couldn't deny the fragility of the body that we inhabit, we couldn't get in a car or a plane. Those of us who live in California would have to leave because earthquakes would be too terrible, and those of us who live in Florida couldn't be here either, and more, none of us could be living anywhere if we couldn't actually do denial. We are all, as they say, Cleopatra, the queen of denial. Denial is a natural defense mechanism. It's a self-protective technique, even though it has this bad reputation. And, of course, it is true. People do use denial in many ways that endanger them. Some people refuse to use condoms and deny that they can become pregnant or get AIDS. Some people drive drunk, denying that alcohol affects their ability to drive. Some people deny their lovers' past transgressions, assuring themselves that they won't be repeated. You know, these are classic examples of the way that people use denial against themselves, but while it is sometimes misused, the capacity for denial is necessary to our survival. Occasionally, an act of God, like an earthquake or a hurricane or a flood or a personal tragedy, like the death of a loved one, will strip away our protective veil of denial and force us to recognize just how fragile we are. Then we suffer. Insomnia, nightmares, flashbacks, anxiety attacks. At times like that, we can't think about our daily life. We lose interest in making a living or falling in love because we're too busy worrying about our safety. But most of us soon are able to reweave our protective veil of denial, and once again, we can go obliviously along about the business of our daily lives. Denial is a lifesaver, and it starts saving your life when you're very young, by helping you pretend that you are not the child your parents don't seem to want. We begin so young. We figure it out so young. Mommy doesn't want a greedy child, or she doesn't want a sloppy child. Daddy doesn't like a boy that cries. Mommy doesn't like a girl who puts herself forward. None of them like a very pretty child or a not pretty child. It doesn't actually matter. We pay so much attention to what it is. I have a client named Natalie, and when she was, you know, very young, her mother took her to a Christmas party at a friend's house, and they had all these presents in front of the tree, and all the kids got a little slip of paper with a number on it, and the number designated, you know, when you could pick out your present. And Natalie got number one. She was beside herself with excitement. She leapt up and she grabbed the biggest present, and then she heard her mother saying, "Put that back. It's not nice to take the biggest present." Well, Natalie at 45 could still remember the shame of that feeling as she put the present back and took the smallest present she could find. Natalie was in no doubt what her mother did want her to be and what her mother didn't want her to be. And so Natalie began a life in which she, first of all, didn't do or ask for what she wanted, and over time she couldn't even figure out what she wanted. She got so good at denial that she didn't even know what she wanted. I'm saying this as though it's a big deal. The truth is, I know that lots and lots of people have this particular cover story. I can't get what I want because I don't know what I want. I'm fond of saying, you know, that the best way to not get what you want is not to know what it is. And lots of us are stuck with that. And people say, well, you know, I've never known what I wanted. And then I have to remind them that this can't possibly be true because all kids know what they want. Maybe you don't remember how you were when you were little, but maybe you've had children. So you know at two, you know, they know what they want to wear and they know what they want to eat and they know when they want to go to sleep and they know where they want to go and they know. It really has to be beaten out of you. Not necessarily, you know, with abuse. Well, not necessarily with, you know, being hit, but in this case, like that, Natalie began the process of not wanting. And it stayed with her all of her life. Well, not all of her life, because we worked on changing that, but it stayed with her for a very long time. So denying what she wanted, is what helped her get through her childhood. Because it was clearly not going to work with mommy for her to be a very wanting child. So in order to be the child mommy wanted, in order to get the praise as opposed to the condemnation, Natalie found the way to say, no, I don't want anything, you know? So your ability to deny the qualities that endangered your relationship with your parents allowed you to forget to this day that you possess those qualities. Those characteristics, whatever they were, you know, in Natalie's case, or her ability to know what she wanted. But people can put competence, sloppiness, intelligence, sentimentality. They haven't gone away. They have just gone undercover. So sometimes, as I have been pointing out, it is precisely the qualities, the ones that you believe you don't have, that you come to need later in life. So, of course, with Natalie, you can perhaps see that she became very bitter. I mean, she was constantly doing things she didn't want to do, and she did not know what to do about it. And she didn't want this life of sacrifice, giving up, of not getting. But she couldn't find her want because she'd denied it, and it had gone safely undercover. So I wonder if you're thinking about what qualities you've led with. What do you say about yourself? Do you say, well, I'm just somebody who doesn't get angry? Or, on the other hand, you know, well, I just have a short fuse. I can't help it. I just go up like a rocket. Or, I've always been frugal. You know, I've always saved. I've always put things away. I feel anxious about, you know, spending too much. Or, I'm a gambler, you know. I don't care. I put it all on the line. So these definitions, because they're so extreme, you know, they don't leave room for the other way of being. I'm a gambler. I don't know how to save. I'm a saver. I don't know how to take risks. You know, I have a short fuse. I don't know how to control my temper. I never get angry. I don't know how to tell people when they're stepping on my feet. This is kind of how it is. This is what cover stories are. They're just one side of the equation. So I wonder if you're beginning to think about what your cover story is and, because of what that is, what you might be keeping undercover, what you might be hiding even from yourself, like Natalie hiding her wants. I'm going to be talking over the next weeks about uncovering. you can see, I think, how important it is to be all that you can be, not to be the limited version that you had to be in order to find your place in your family, make your family comfortable, make the best spot you could in your family. So, as I said, over time I'll be talking about uncovering, and I hope that between now and the time I start talking about that, you might be paying attention to how you represent yourself, what you think about yourself, what do other people say about you, what are the qualities that you lead with, and see them as maybe just your cover. And maybe there's more to you than you thought. And of course, that's what this show is all about. Finding out the more. Getting it back. Being all that you can be. And not taking it to the army. Oh, well, you can take it to the army if you want to. Well, okay, so we're about ready for the interview with Robert Mann. And right before I play that interview, I'm going to play a very short public service announcement. And then you will hear my voice, followed by the voice of independent filmmaker, comedian Robert Mann.
My son was drinking too much. When did he spiral out of control? Should I have seen the warning signs? Somehow I felt I was responsible for his drinking. I was very frustrated. I knew I had to get help. When I came to Al-Anon, I wanted to straighten out my son's life. His drinking was tearing our family apart. In Al-Anon family groups, I found people who understood and cared because they were dealing with the same problems I was. My first Al-Anon meeting gave me hope and the knowledge that I was not alone.
Before you can help the problem drinker in your life, you need to help yourself first. For an Al-Anon family group meeting near you, call 1-888-4-ALANON, 1-888-425-2666. Online at www.alanonfamilygroups.org. That's alanonfamilygroups.org. A message from Al-Anon Family Groups.
So here I am in Los Angeles with Robert Mann.
Yes.
Who is almost family.
Almost. Without the contract.
Yeah. He's almost related to somebody that I'm almost related to.
That's true.
So I know you a long time now, Robert.
Yes, you have.
I'll bet I know you almost 20 years. My God.
Maybe.
That's pretty amazing.
It's amazing.
You are at least 20, aren't you?
I am. You knew me when I was an infant.
I did. It did. So Robert is an actor and a director and a writer. And I've been explaining to him that I do this series of interviews with artists. And I interview people who make their living or their life with their art. And it sounds to me like you are actually making your living with your art now, although I knew you when you were making your life with it, but not your living. Isn't that true?
Kind of. It's getting better and better.
Yeah.
You know, 20 years later, it's that overnight
right.
success story.
Yes, that's right, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I always ask the people that I interview and what I'm mostly interested in is how you got captured by the art. I mean, and since I know you, you have been dedicated to this. So I know that it is the passion in your life that you were captured by it. So I like to know how it happened, how you found it, how it found you, how you discovered that this was important for you, that kind of stuff.
It happened when I was a kid, and it's weird because when you talk about something like this, I don't think you find it finds you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's instilled in you on some level, spiritual level. But when I was around 12, 13, my mother was an actress, and she was dating a director. And so I got to hang out at the sets, and I used to read her lines, and she would rehearse them with me. And going back and forth to the studio, I would be involved. Well, the director then gave me my first camera. So then I just started shooting things.
Wow.
And when I was on set and watching them do what they were doing, to me it was like magic. It was like, oh my God. It was like a great magician. Oh, you can do that? And then he had me double up as one of the lead characters on a close-up shot with my mother and I walking. So the character was drunk in a wide shot, and you would see them, the character and the girlfriend, stumbling around. Now remember, I'm only like 13,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So the character was probably 22, 23. So the director says, oh yeah, just put on his pants and his shoes, and my mom was going to put on the other character's dress and her shoes. And I'm thinking, well, how is it? I'm not, you know, this guy. They're going to know the difference. And but he just shot very close up on the feet, and then he told me just act drunk, so I was stumbling along. And then when I saw the screening, and he cut it all together, then he cut back to the wide, I go, oh, look at that. And I'm going to my mom. That's my feet. Those are my feet. I'm telling all my friends, right?
Yeah.
But it looked like it was the other characters. So the magic of that just kind of instilled in me, and I just thought it was fascinating how you could fake all this stuff and make it look real. And I think that's it. It's just play. It's just, you know, when you're playing army or whatever you're playing. And to me, I took my camera and I would just shoot anything. I would shoot a dog. I'd shoot a leaf. Whatever it was, I'd shoot myself. We got into a dark room and with sparklers because I wanted to see how dark I could get it and what kind of lighting would affect that I could get with the sparklers. And just things like that. And then...
So you were in school with yourself, essentially. I mean, you were studying... Literally, you were discovering this stuff for yourself.
Yeah, and at that time, since I had an 8mm camera, Super 8mm camera, it was before the video came out, I would do what was called edit in camera. So I wouldn't even cut the film. I would just have my scenes, and I knew I'd cut at this point. So we'd rehearse it with my friends, and we'd make a movie, and we'd just have it cut in camera. So I'd have a wide shot, and we'd stop at a certain point, and I'd just stop the camera. Then I'd come in for the close-up, and I'd start the camera again.
Okay, so you were already directing and editing, right, at the same time that you were shooting.
Yeah.
You were already doing the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. It was all in my mind. It wasn't really so much on paper. But
in your mind. That's exactly right. But you were creating it, what was in your mind,
mm-hmm.
right? A finished product, essentially.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. And then I started getting to editing. Then I started shooting, being able to trim stuff, and... I'd be there splicing my little thing and had my projector.
And how old are you now?
Probably into like 15, 16 now, you know, 14.
So you're already making movies.
I made hundreds of little short films of family and friends.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there was never any question about what you wanted to do? Or did you, on the side, you thought maybe I'll be an accountant?
Well, on the side, I also, you know, had this... wonderful dream of being Joe Namath, you know, and winning a Super Bowl. Yeah, I know.
I just looked down at him. He's this slender guy.
Yeah. The physical stature wasn't right.
Your body didn't cooperate.
Didn't cooperate.
But your mind cooperated with this other thing.
Yeah, it's just fun, you know, and so that's kind of how it happened. And when it came time to make a decision in college, because I'm not the biggest guy, you know, 5'11", 165, or whatever it is. I figured, well, you know, I'll probably get smashed playing football, so maybe I should just put all my energy into the arts now. And that's kind of what happened. I became a theater major with a visual arts minor, and so I did film and theater, and just kind of combined all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so, all right, so now we have you exiting... college with your degrees under your belt.
Yes.
But...
Which, by the way, mean nothing in this field.
Right, yes, right.
They don't mean anything.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, nobody is asking you where you went to school and what grades you got and what degrees you have. When they don't care.
They don't care. They just say, you know, audition, read this line, or let me see your reel, or whatever it is.
Well, but...
But let me regress on that.
Yeah.
I got the training, and that was valuable to me. The actual degree doesn't mean anything in this business, but the training did, and so I felt comfortable with that.
Well, I'm interested in that because what I'm thinking is that by the time you got to college, you had more hands-on experience with the stuff you were going to do than a lot of the people who must have been going to school with you. Isn't that true?
Some did, you know,
some other people found it the way you did and been doing it all their lives.
Yeah, but very few, and you know, you went to college and you kind of went down that road. And also, when I went to college, I took animation classes.
Mm.
You know, I took directing classes.
Things that you couldn't have taught yourself.
Yes, and I would get other points of view, and even philosophy classes would help, and psychology classes to understand the psyche of a character.
Yeah, motivation.
Yeah. And sociology. I was a soc minor also. So all of those formed ideas for me and how to create a world of fiction from actual reality.
So you found this, or it found you really young. You chose it, really, when you went to college. You got all this training. Okay, now you're 21, 22 years old, and you're out there in the world. Then what happened?
I started crying.
Yeah. Yes. Right.
I go, hey, it's supposed to be easier than this. And
who told you that?
I don't know. Somebody said it was supposed to be easier. You just figure, you know, you do these steps.
Yeah.
The logical steps. And I think it works in a lot of fields. But in the arts, it doesn't necessarily work that way.
No, it doesn't.
But what I did was, I did a play that I wrote and directed and helped produce with a buddy of mine, and we set it up at the Improv, and it was a night that the Improv was dark, and we invited all industry people, agents and producers and managers and things like that. Well, we did that, and we did it. It was a one-hour bit of theater called In by Eight, Out by Nine. We had wine there for the agents and casting directors and people, and we had cheese plates and things like that. So you could come in there and just have a little hour of theater. We wanted them to get in and out, literally in and out in an hour. And so we did that. We found an agent, or an agent found us. She said, hey, you guys work really great together. You should do some stand-up comedy. And so started doing stand-up comedy with a comedy team. And
writing your old stuff.
Writing our own stuff and then performing it, which was the greatest thing about stand-up, because you can get instant satisfaction.
Or the other.
But you know right away.
Right.
So you go in and you do it, and you're always working. Whereas if you're a regular actor, you know, you've got to audition, and you got to wait, and you go into classes, and you're always at the mercy of somebody else. And so anyway, I did that, and then did that for a while, and then I started getting into independent films and writing scripts.
How did that happen?
That happened when we no longer started doing the stand-up comedy. So I needed to find some other work. But that has always been a progression to the film and writing and directing and producing films. So at the time, actually, when I was still doing stand-up, I wrote my first script. And then when we broke up, then I went back to film school and got into a film school called the Hollywood Film Institute. And it was basically weekend courses. And so I did that, figured out how to do producing, and then I raised, as you know, about $100,000 to do my first feature film. And so that's how that happened.
Which you wrote.
Which I wrote, directed.
And directed, right.
And I acted it.
And exactly. So tell the story of that.
The story of that, well, there was a point to where I'm going, well...
And how old are you now when you're doing this?
30-something.
Okay, so you've been in the world, out of college, for about 10 years when you did this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, I'm doing this, and I opened up my own company called Manatee Films, and I realized that in order to get anything done, I had to actually go out there and hustle and try to get the money and make this. And the goal was to do it, you know, in a year. And I had a lot of help, a lot of support, as you know.
Oh, yes,
from,
I do.
Yeah, from you, from your sister, from Harry. And I used their house.
Yes, I know.
That was part of the perk.
I know.
So, and my thing, as you know, is I just had to strip the painting and repaint it and do the walls. But that's what you do as an independent filmmaker.
That's right. You do everything.
Yeah. They give you the house and you paint it.
Right, exactly.
And then you repaint it.
And you put it back the way it was if you can.
Or better,
right.
Yeah, you want to do it better. So once I had the house, I had a director of photography who got me a camera package for free from Panavision, which I'm still thanking them for. And it was a 35 millimeter camera. It wasn't the newest, but it worked, and it was great, and I got to shoot on 35mm. And the film stock was all short ends and long ends. I got some donation from Fuji, but most of the time I would...
Remnants.
Yeah. Somebody would use a 1,000-foot reel, and they would only use 400 feet of it. I'd buy 600 feet for a much lesser price. And then I was getting 50 feet, 25 feet for close-ups and stuff. I said, sure, fine, give me that. It was like 2-3 cents a foot. Wow. Fine, I'll take it. Give me anything. I'll utilize it.
Then you're splicing everything together.
Well, not really, because if you plan it right, I can. It's 90 feet a minute. So let's say I have a 90-foot reel. I can shoot my master, which is maybe a 2-minute scene, and then come up on a close-up. I have 90. I know I have 90 feet on the small one,
yeah.
Or 40 feet, and then I can just get a couple close-ups. My film loader hated me because I'm always loading film.
Film, right. Well, and what occurs to me also is that all that practice you got editing in camera, I mean, you got really good very young at knowing how long things would take, how much you could get in a thing, how to, you know,
yeah.
This probably stood you in good stead.
Yeah, what also stood me in good stead was the fact that because I grew up with my buddies and we would write it, we'd shoot it, we'd act in it, it was very easy for me to make the transition into a regular film as a writer, director, actor.
Yeah.
So it was very comfortable for me to be in front of the camera and behind the camera. It almost seems odd just doing one. I don't feel like I'm really doing my job.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't see that. I do get what you mean.
Yeah. So that was...
So you could do it all?
At times, yeah. You know, and a lot of people ask me, well, would the film have been better if you were just directing or if you were just acting? And I go, well, I don't know, but
well, it wouldn't have been yours.
It would have been different.
Yeah, right. Right. No, this is your vision.
Yeah.
And you are capable of putting your vision in it.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, brain surgery. It's not molecular, you know, structure. It's just like a kid. You get up, you practice the shot, you rehearse it, and then you have a stand and your buddies in there, and you kind of line up the shot, and then you tell your buddy, get out, and then you go in, and the cameraman shoots what you just set up. So it's relatively simple.
See, I think that it isn't,
yeah.
Really. But I do think that when you've been doing it since you're 13, it's a skill in your cells. That I don't think it's necessarily simple for people who start doing it in their 30s.
Maybe not.
Do you understand what
no,
I mean?
No, I
mean, you
that.
Own it. You've
yeah.
been doing it all your life. It's not... Yeah. And I do think that... That is one of the advantages of being captured by an art very young,
mm-hmm.
is that by the time you're a grown-up and you're doing it professionally, it's just yours.
Mm-hmm.
It just spills out of you, you know. And you can always see the difference. I interviewed last week a young man, he's 23, I think, who is they call him a phenom, right, sax player.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been playing since he's 13. And in his early teen years, he got the opportunity to play with a series of big bands. And he couldn't keep up with them, and he didn't know the songs. And every night he would go home and make himself learn the songs he didn't know that they played that time, so that the following week he would go back, he would know those tunes.
Yeah,
so that,
sure.
You know. So by the time he got to music, you know, by the time he got to college, he could play anything.
Right.
He could follow any chord, you know, he could, but almost nobody he was in school with could do that stuff.
Right.
But it wasn't hard for him.
Right, yeah, it's a kind of a left brain, right brain thing too. And when I say it's not hard, maybe for me, it's preparation, because, you know, once you rehearse and you rehearse and rehearse as an actor, you kind of have it. And if you're trained well enough, you can kind of turn it on and turn it off.
Yes.
Because it's already in you. You've
yes.
rehearsed it. If you just did it cold, I think it would be more difficult. And then the directing part of it, you've spent all your time on that side of the fence with your DP, lining up the shots, and everything is just on a page then, and it's all, you know, shot 1A is a, you know, a wide shot, shot, you know, 1B is this. And so you just kind of, okay, what's the next shot? And you go through it
right.
mechanically. So it's two separate sides. One is on some levels, is kind of mechanical, and the other one is much more emotional and feeling.
And creative.
Yeah, they're both creative in their own way. But like Alfred Hitchcock, he said all the creative process is done in pre-production. Once he got on set, the film was already shot. I mean, all the shots were lined up. He just went down his list.
He'd done all the work.
He did all the work. Creative work.
Yeah, I got it. Okay.
So once you're on set, then, especially for him, now there's other directors that work differently. Some like to get on set and then kind of figure out the shot and whatever. But Hitchcock had it all in his mind, and then he jotted it all down, had all the shots down. He knew what the lighting was going to look like. And once you were on set, you just went.
This is like the difference between writers who write detailed outlines for their work before they start and other writers who just sit down and start it and it sort of rolls out of them. Mm-hmm. And different people work differently.
Exactly.
Okay, so you made this film.
Made the film
It
Trapped.
Was not easy. What?
Trapped.
Right. Yes, exactly right. Okay, and what happened?
Trapped, then we took it to festivals. I went to the San Diego Film Festival, which it was one of the top three in its category, which is a feature film. And it didn't win the prize, but it was in the top three, and I was happy about that. The one that did win was a $5 million project, which so thinking maybe I would have had a little more money.
Yeah, right.
But I like the film for what it is. It's really, in essence, a stage play on film. Because it was my first feature, I didn't want to overwhelm myself with it. As you know, it all basically took place in one house.
Mm-hmm.
I think the hardest thing about the film from an audience point of view or even from a writer's point of view is to keep interest in it when you're in one location.
Yeah.
You know, there's no tricks to go here. There's no jump cuts. There's really none of this stuff happening. You know, explosions, whatever. You're really into the characters. And having the twists and turns in the one space is difficult. But I think once you're into it, you're sucked into that room and that life and everything, then you're in for a nice little ride if you just sit back and enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then what?
After Trapped, I kept writing, and I was writing more and more scripts, and I was sending them out, and getting some response, some good, some bad. And I came across a producer who also wrote a film or produced a film called Trapped. And I was at a distributor for my film, Trapped, and the distributor said, hey, you know, there's this guy who had a film that I distributed, you know, 5 years earlier. It's called Trapped 2. You should get in contact with him. You both have the same film name. Okay, so I did, and he proposed a horror film idea that he had. And he said, read this script and tell me what you like. He goes, I'll produce it and you can rewrite it and direct it if you choose. So I read the script. I didn't like the script at all. And he said, well, come up with something else. And he wanted a Halloween theme. He wanted something like that. I said, well, give me a couple days. So I came up with The Pumpkin Carver.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked that one. And essentially, it took, from that moment, it took about 5.5 years before it was written, rewritten, rewritten again, rewritten, rewritten, raised the money, rewritten again, and then we shot it in about 19 days, something like that. And that was shot on Super 16. And that became very successful. We got it in 20 Blockbusters. First Look distributed it. Again, it was a low-budget film. It wasn't, you know, it didn't cost a whole lot. Basically three times the amount of my first film. But we got it in, every Blockbuster had about 20 units in it. It's been on Showtime, it's been on demand.
Wow.
It's been on...
So has it paid for itself?
Not according to the distributor. According to the distributor, it has made two to three times its money, but we're still in the red on it. So
does that mean you haven't made any money?
They paid us a chunk up front. They almost paid us entirely for the cost of the film. We almost broke even. But there were some lawyer fees and things like that. So probably about 80% is what the investors got back for their money. And I'm trying diligently to shake up the company and
make some money.
You know, because then I can go back to my investors and they'll give me more money to make more films because they made money on this one.
Right.
So
is that, so that's what's happening now, is that do you have your next film? Do you know what it is?
The next film that I'm doing is called Piper and Tupper, and it's Groovy Gurus of Rock and Roll, and it's sort of like a cross between Spinal Tap and Wayne's World.
Mm-hmm.
And it's two groovy guys from the...
Groovy guys, oh my God.
Two groovy guys born at Woodstock, and they come back to the world in today's present day to...
You mean literally born at Woodstock?
Literally.
I mean, they've given birth to.
At Woodstock. That's the story.
That's great.
Yeah, and they both have the same father. So there's an opening scene where you'll see the father just shifts when they go. Oh, there's a birth here, born at Woodstock. Show, you know, raised a little baby, and the one is raised. Piper is raised, and they go, and where's the father? And the father is standing right beside her. Oh, and then the announcer gets another message. Hey, we understand there's another baby born at Woodstock. And we hold up the baby, and a lady, literally next to the other lady, holds up her child, which is now Tupper.
Right.
And well, where's the father? And the father slides from one to the other.
So they're brothers.
They're half brothers.
Right.
On some level, yeah. And so from there we go.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so is that shot?
It's not shot. We just shot a short.
Oh, that's the short I just saw.
Yeah, that was a short, and it's a promotional short for the
character. Raise money?
To raise money, to help raise money, and to give an idea of what these characters are.
Yeah.
And we're going to enter that in festivals for shorts.
Great.
And see if we get some buzz on it see how people enjoy it.
Well, okay, so now, earlier I said that you... Are you making a living at this?
I am now. I was in Italy.
Recently. Yes, tell that story.
Yeah, so I was in Italy, and I got hired to write...
You got hired in Italy?
No, I got hired here.
Ah.
And this is a really... you talk about karma or positive energy coming full circle. A producer friend of mine who is with my company, I had turned him on to another friend of mine who was casting a film. Or I should say producing a film. And I wanted my friend Craig, who's on my producing team, I wanted him to get more experience on hands-on film, on set. And so I called Dan Harris, who was my line producer on The Pumpkin Carver. I said, Dan, you got anything going on right now? And he says, oh yeah, I'm working on this film in Italy. And I said, well listen, can you use some help? And he goes, yeah, I can always use some help. And so I said, okay, well I got a producer here. I want to have him get more hands-on experience. His name's Craig. He goes, sure, have him come over. He goes, the only thing is he'll probably have to fly himself out there, but everything else he'll have per diem, and we'll pay him a little bit, and yada, yada, yada. And so it was for like a two-week shoot. And so he goes over there, and he does his thing. They go to Venice, and they shoot in Venice. They shoot in Rome. And so it was a really nice thing, and he really enjoyed it. He made a few contacts. One of them was an Italian director named Davide Sinsis. So he makes a good connection with Davide. They loved him. And so Craig comes back, and when he comes back, he's talking, Davide is talking to Craig about this project that he's doing. He was already in Italy, and they were talking about the project. And they were looking for an American writer. And Craig says, I got just the guy for you.
Oh, God.
Because the piece was more spiritual. The piece that Davide wanted to do, it's called Last Shot. And it's about two brothers who go searching for their parents who were lost at sea. And it's a very spiritual piece. Anyway, because I'm into a lot of that, and
yes.
Eckhart Tolle and Ram Dass and all these other things, Craig thought I'd be a perfect fit for that, because Davide reads all these books also.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yes. So he calls me up. No, he emails. It's all email from Italy. We email back and forth. Craig set it up. I sent him the script. Davide...
Sent him what script?
I sent him Roberto's Friend. I sent him another script that I wrote called Roberto's Friend. And that's about Roberto Clemente, who comes back as a 12-year-old boy to help his best friend manage a bunch of foster home juvenile delinquent little leaguers.
Ooh.
Yeah. So it's got a really nice vibe, and it's very
spiritual.
Very spiritual. So he reads it, he really likes it, and he basically hired me on the spot. So he sent me out to Italy, and I was paid in euros. They set me up in a really nice place. I was 5 minutes from the Vatican, and they thought it was going to be about a month for me to be there. and it was X amount of dollars for that month on the, X amount of dollars to write the screenplay, and then X amount on the back end. When I ended up spending 3 months there.
Wow.
So, getting back to the original question about it, paying for myself, I made a nice little chunk there, so now I'm kind of like coasting on that little bit of money. But it was nice. I got a per diem. They set me up, and they gave me a salary. And it was in euros. So when I brought it back to the States...
It was a lot.
It was a lot more.
Yes, it was a lot. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I said earlier about making your living or your life with your art, you know, it's so hard to make a living with your art in this culture. But I guess you can always go to Europe where it's easier.
You can always go to Europe.
Yeah,
sure.
Right.
And so... Yeah, he's going to shoot it here, and I'm hoping to work on set also with...
Well, and who knows what else this can turn itself into.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes, the overnight success. So how old are you now?
Close to that age. We never divulge our age.
Boy, okay.
This is Hollywood. Come on.
Oh, I forgot. Right? I forgot. Yeah, I know. You're 28.
Right? Let me put it I'm older than some and not as young as others. And my mother said, never tell your age. And I always listen to my mother.
Oh, okay, good. I won't say anything about that. All right, that's really great. So I ask people, is there anything I didn't ask you or anything you want to say about a life dedicated, you know, to an art or anything at all?
Well, in this field... You really have to love what you're doing, and I think it's probably true in all the fields, but you have to be willing to do it for free. I mean, otherwise, what's the point?
I just want to tell you, everybody says that.
Yeah.
The musicians say that, the actors say that, the writers say that, the fine artists say that, they all say the same thing. Yeah. If you're doing this for the money, you're in the wrong place.
You are. If the money comes, and I think if you just continue to do what you love, it'll come, you know, on some level.
Well, you can do it anyway.
Yeah, but you have to do it. You know, it's like you cannot not do it.
Yes.
You know, otherwise you're going to be very unhappy. So you might as well do that. You get another job. One of my first acting instructors said, if you choose this profession, you're going to be living your whole life with a monkey on your back, carrying a monkey on your back, mm-hmm. because unless you're very lucky and you're a Tom Cruise or you're a Martin Scorsese or something like that to where you're recognized quickly and like a Spielberg. You can make a living at it, and it's great. But the others, you know, 99% of us have to schlep around and, you know, beg, borrow, and steal to get our work done.
Right. And it's worth it because you need to do the work.
Yeah. And the thing is, you don't have to... I just did the short.
Right.
You don't have to make a huge feature film for X amount of dollars. I did the short for $4,000.
Mm-hmm.
But you're doing what you love. You can do a play. You can produce a play. You can do that very inexpensively. You know, you can write. That doesn't cost you anything.
No, right.
Just paper. So there's all sorts of ways to have this creative outlet for yourself. And even you know, if you want to direct something, and there's nightclubs you can do things at. So there's all sorts of venues to have a you know, a release.
Not everybody has your
brain damage.
Well, sense of humor, but that's not what I was going to say. You know.
Oh, by the way, you need a sense of humor too.
Yes, right. Absolutely,
Yeah. Absolutely.
But I do think that it is that compulsion, you know, that not only keeps you doing it, but makes you able to say what you just said, which is there's always a way to do it if you want to do it.
Yeah, and you just have to get up off the couch and put down the Nintendo and the Game Boy and,
right.
and the, you know, the Wii and do it. Because that's really, really, for me, it's what it's about. You know, I could sit home and do what I do and have that enjoyment, but I'd rather be doing this.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it just fulfills me more, and it's a lot more fun.
Thank you so much, Robert.
No, thank you. Loved it.
Yeah, me too.
And there you have Robert Mann having discovered film at 8. He made it his life, and it's not easy to do, as you probably heard. But it's what he said. You know, he has to do it. It fulfills him. And I am hoping that everybody listening has something that fulfills them, not necessarily filmmaking, but that you know what that is for you. And that's, of course, the theme, the thrust, the meaning of this show, to find out who you are and what floats your boat. So, as we are running out of time, I want to thank the intrepid Josh Hackney, who, as always, makes this show possible, makes me as comfortable as I can possibly be with the technology that goes with this show, and to tell you that if you need someone to help you be comfortable with technology, if you've got questions about computers, electronics, recording, you want Josh Hackney, and go up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynnesow.com, and click on email me and say I want Josh, or whatever you want to say to me. And if it's I want Josh, I'll get him for you. Well, all right. I hope, as always, that you heard something here that you can use, something that you didn't know, or something that you knew but you forgot, or something that you want to try and hold on to, or something that amused you, or something that's going to bring you back. Because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten